From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today at a White House Rose Garden event honoring Air Force Academy football players, President Trump took a moment to urge Republicans in Congress to pass a plan to repeal and replace President Obama's signature health care law, the Affordable Care Act.
How's health care coming, folks? How's it doing? All right, we're moving along. I think it's time now, right? Right? They know it's time.
But emerging from a closed-door meeting this morning, House Speaker Paul Ryan ducked reporter questions about whether he has enough votes to pass the bill. Centrist Republicans are having a hard time getting on board with changes to mandatory coverage for people with pre-existing medical conditions. NPR health policy reporter Allison Kojak joins us now with the latest. Hi, Allison.
Hey, Jeremy.
And it doesn't sound right now like Republicans have the votes they need to pass this. How close is it?
Well, it's very close right now. So on the assumption that there are no Democrats who are going to vote for this bill, Republicans can only afford to lose 22 votes. And most of the people who are doing the counting say they've already got 20 firm no's. And so they can't lose a lot more people before they're not going to be able to take a vote on this bill.
And I assume that they would bring it to a vote if they had the votes right now. So we can assume at the moment, right as we speak right now, they don't have the votes. Is mandatory coverage of pre-existing conditions the major sticking point for lawmakers right now?
Yes, it is. And that was the big change that happened last week, how people were going to cover mandatory pre-existing conditions. And what happened is they allowed this waiver that states could take that would get rid of some of those coverages. And it's made a lot of the more moderate Republicans really uncomfortable with whether or not people will get the protection they need. In fact, just this morning, Congressman Fred Upton, who's a really well-respected member of the Republican conference, said he's no.
Hmm. And President Trump created a little bit of confusion about this, about what the plan says about pre-existing conditions. He said in an interview that they're covered. Health experts dispute that, pointing out exactly what you're saying, that it does leave a little more leeway to states. Here's Republican Congressman Steve Scalise this morning.
And I want to talk a little bit about pre-existing conditions because that's come up a lot. Our bill protects people with pre-existing conditions, and it actually provides multiple layers of protection for people with pre-existing conditions in ways that Obamacare doesn't do.
But again, Allison, you're saying that it does allow states to do things that Obamacare does not allow them to do when it comes to pre-existing conditions.
Yeah, and so it's a little murky whether or not you're covered. Might depend on where you live. If a state decides to opt out of some of the Obamacare rules, then they have to put in place something that will allow people with pre-existing conditions to buy insurance. But it's not clear exactly how protective those most people think will be called high-risk pools will be. In the past, states have used high-risk pools, and they haven't been funded enough to actually get people who are very sick the coverage they need.
Hmm. What does this bill do on Medicaid? That was another big sticking point the last time around when they didn't pass the bill. Republicans didn't have the votes. What does this one do on Medicaid?
Well, Medicaid hasn't changed since the last time around, so that's obviously another problem. What it does is it allows it requires states to roll back the Medicaid expansion in the sense that if they have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare, which meant that people who weren't qualified for Medicaid before would have access to it now, those people can stay on Medicaid as long as they don't become unqualified, meaning they earn a little more money. Once they do, they're out of it for good. Hmm. The other thing it does is it turns Medicaid into a block grant program. And that is, I mean, states can do that if they want. It's not required. But if they do that, chances are the money going to Medicaid in those states will be less than it is now.
What other things are you watching in this bill?
Well, that's actually an interesting question because under these waivers, it's unclear how far those will go. If a state opts to get rid of the Obamacare rules that define essential health benefits, what an insurance plan has to cover, and protects people with pre-existing conditions, it could be that employers, you know, people who get their insurance through large employers can also roll back their coverage for cheaper plans. They can't do that now because those rules apply to employer coverage now as well as individual coverage. So people are taking a look at what will happen with employer-sponsored health coverage if a state, if this plan is adopted.
Is this week do or die for this plan?
It could be because The plan, the revisions are being done under a sort of legislative trick that is tied to the budget. If they can't get it done, they have to move on to next year's budget. And Republicans want to do tax reform, and they'll need a different budget to do that.
That's Allison Kojak, NPR health policy reporter. We'll keep watching what happens in Washington. Allison, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The Trump administration is proposing major cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency. And in addition to losing their livelihoods, many EPA workers are worried that there will be fewer people combating pollutants or protecting water supplies. Some of them want to speak up, but being in the public eye makes many of these scientists and lawyers uncomfortable. So in Chicago, some EPA employees are getting public relations training so they can make their case. Lauren Chilton from WBEZ in Chicago reports.
Being interviewed by a public radio reporter is maybe the last thing on earth that Nicole Cantello wants to be doing.
Is this uncomfortable for you right now?
Yes.
I know you're like not even looking at me.
I know. I don't want to be I want to talk to the press. Sorry. Cantello is an attorney and union steward for the Chicago-based branch of the EPA that covers six Great Lakes states. And for almost all of her 27-year career, if reporters called, she would hang up on them. But Cantello says as she watched the returns come in on election night and it was clear Donald Trump was going to win, she knew she was going to have to change her ways.
Just sitting there in the bar that I was watching the election in with my two girlfriends, I just realized that it was that I had this huge, daunting task ahead and no one else was going to step into my place. No one was going to want to do it. And I was going to have to do all of this work that I didn't want to do.
Cantello says she and other union leaders figured the EPA was going to be on the chopping block, and they were right. In his budget, President Donald Trump is proposing a 31% cut to the EPA. And there have been rumors that the administration would close the Chicago regional office, though they've been disputed by EPA leaders. So Cantello and her colleagues started brainstorming who else they should enlist for battle.
And we thought we had to hire a lobbyist. We thought we had to hire a lobbyist for Congress. But several people, including several senators, said to us, no, you should hire a publicist.
So that's exactly what they did. That's why today, Cantello and seven of her union colleagues are using their lunch break to take a storytelling class.
We're just brainstorming a list of possible things that you, stories that you could tell.
It's led by Joanna Klonsky, who is usually found in Chicago's City Hall juggling press requests for aldermen. But today's lesson is not only how to be comfortable with the press, but how a group of incredibly smart scientists and attorneys can stop sounding like, well, scientists and attorneys.
So we're talking about coming up with how to tell a story that takes the information about what you do out of sort of wonk land and brings it down to earth for regular folks like me who are not scientists to understand and relate to.
Each of the students, so to speak, are asked to write an outline of a pivotal moment in their career and then share their story with the class. Ediberto Leon goes first.
I remember in particular in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, for the 10 Mile Drain Superfund site, we had announced an open house because we had to send a number of letters out to residents to tell them that the state of Michigan was revising its standards for PCBs, which is the contaminant of concern at this particular site.
So not to pick on Leon because it was super brave to go first, but his story is a perfect example of why everyone showed up today. He launches into a long story about PCBs, eventually getting to a scene where a woman won't listen to the EPA workers because she said she didn't trust the government. But as you can tell, it takes him a while to get there. Klonsky, the teacher, kindly asks Leon and the students to figure out what the nut of the story is. In other words, what's the part that's going to stick with people?
So it's important that they get the message.
PCBs, bioaccumulating
right.
fish.
Right. They could fish in Lake Clair or St. Clair Shores. And so if she doesn't believe the government, she might go and fish there and ingest it and get PCB poisoning.
So they get the message, but then all that goes sideways into a conversation about PCB bioaccumulation.
People don't know what that means.
And
isn't it more toxic as it goes up the as it goes up the food chain?
That's called biomagnification. Bioaccumulation is where you eat it and it goes into your fat.
Eventually, everyone does agree that these probably aren't words that most non-science people understand. And so if they want to get across the importance of the EPA's work for public health, they've got to use simpler language. Many of the people in this room say they're completely shocked it's come to this. They never imagined they'd be in the New York Times or the Chicago Reader. But one student, attorney Jeff Levino, says he knew this day would come, no matter who won the election.
the Environmental Protection Agency has done a wonderful job. And it has done it so well and so quietly, people have forgotten how well and how quietly we do our work. Yep. There's, you know, my wife and I keep a pretty clean home. My children think it occurs naturally. It doesn't.
Lovino says he grew up in Sterling, Illinois, and he remembers seeing black smoke pouring out of factory smokestacks 24 hours a day, and what a victory it was for the community when that factory finally shut down.
The bottom line is we have forgotten what it was like in the 60s and 70s, when air was black, when water caught fire. We need to remind people that the reason we need to continue to do this is because we don't want to go back to that.
So Lovino and his colleagues are trying to arm themselves with some new skills so they can fight these old battles. For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Chulgin in Chicago.
About 20 years ago, the great jazz impresario Freddie Taylor and I wondered, where's Jimmy Webb? The man Rolling Stone called arguably the most successful mainstream songwriter alive seemed to have disappeared. Well, we found him, brought him to a small club Fred managed here in Boston. But he resisted at first. No one wants to hear my music anymore. He was wrong.
Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have the recipe again.
Okay, MacArthur Park does go on, but then there's Galveston, the moon's a harsh mistress, adios. Tomorrow there will be a tribute concert for Jimmy Webb in New York. He's donating all the proceeds to the Alzheimer's Foundation in honor of his dear friend Glenn Campbell. And he's got a new memoir out about his rise from son of Oklahoma farmers and Baptist preachers to hard-living superstar hanging with Sinatra, Joni Mitchell, you name it. But it was fueled by affairs and drugs. He crashed a glider. It didn't kill him, but an overdose almost did. His book is The Cake in the Rain, and Jimmy Webb joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you again, particularly.
How would you describe this guy in the book?
You know, it starts out almost as a pastoral. I was truly a laborer, a farm laborer. And when my father got behind the pulpit and began preaching, I brought my work ethic to the First Baptist Church. And by the time I was 12 years old, I was the church pianist. Mm. That was my mother's. She thought that was the apex of show business. I think as you read along, you realize that, hey, you know, this is getting to be something that this guy is not able to handle.
Right. Because who could?
You know?
How old were you when you wrote Up, Up, and Away, by the time I get to Phoenix, Paper Cup, MacArthur Park? How old?
That would be 18, 19, and 20.
Yeah. You were appearing on the late night shows like Johnny Carson, and you had a kind of a meltdown in the middle of trying to do, I think it was MacArthur Park.
It broke down completely. I just looked around at the band and said, 1, 2, 3, 4.
It started him again.
I mean, I felt like killing myself.
You, I think, were straddling two worlds. Frank Sinatra loved you, but there was this rock and roll thing happening that was rejecting that world. Maybe you were, you know, going through some of the drugs and stuff so that you could be accepted in that other new world.
Well, I think that there's little doubt about it, because I mentioned in the book that I read somewhere something about me and drugs and thought to myself, now we're getting somewhere. You know, I know that's a very bad joke, but I actually was trying very hard to be in that club. It was a very exclusive club. Linda Ronstadt would tell me years later, she would say, who did we think we were setting ourselves up in a kind of a hierarchy and keeping some people out? And John Denver and Donny Osmond. They weren't in. So you really had to establish one's credentials as a lefty, as a liberal, which I was anyway. But you know, Gil Scott Heron, when he wrote that poem about the revolution will not be televised, he sort of went out of his way to say that the song of the revolution would not be written by Jimmy Webb, and it was those kinds of slights, if you will, that I felt were uncalled for, because they were judging me because Glenn Campbell cut my tunes.
Yeah. And what the joke now, of course, is that, you know, Glenn Campbell revered, the music revered.
I call it our rehabilitation. That's what I call it.
I mean, when you were putting this together, are you thinking, how did I survive this?
Well, you know, I very nearly didn't. You know, there was part of me that was trying to stay alive. There's another part of me that said, well, if the Beatles are doing it and if they want you to do it, then you should be doing it.
Yeah.
I want to be a part. I want to be in this, you know. But I think that I managed to chart some territory for myself as an artist.
I think you did okay as an artist. I think you did okay.
Well, now I haven't sold any records, Robin. So
well, that not many are, you know. Now
I can remember hearing Frank Sinatra, Mr. Sinatra, sing one of my songs on the radio.
This time we almost made the pieces fit, didn't we? This time.
And I'm driving in my Mercedes 405 SEL. And just for a minute, it hit me. I'm a part of this moment, and I don't know how this happened. And it would be almost like a moment of absolute terror, confusion. When you look at some of the contemporary artists and the way they've left us in very tragic ways, and you go, how could that happen? So much promise and so much. And it's because they are overtaken by events.
And not the music.
No, yeah. No.
You write about, you know, you're a childhood sweetheart who, you know, who becomes your girlfriend, Susie Horton. I did not know that a lot of the songs that you wrote were for her, but it bothered her because, as you write, it was a, you know, sort of a psychological weapon. You'd write, by the time I get to Phoenix, Wichita Lineman, MacArthur Park.
I don't think that you can beat a hit song when it comes to a psychological weapon. They were heartbroken laments. She was everything I'd ever dreamed of, and she got married to a school teacher.
Yeah, but you went out with some married woman, so you put it even there.
Oh, those married women, that's going to haunt me.
But I tell you, you could not go anywhere. You couldn't go. She couldn't have gone anywhere without hearing them, all three.
Yes,
all the
it
time.
Was... I actually did that to more than one person.
talk about Glenn Campbell.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another.
I love the anecdote about when you're making Wichita Lineman with him. There was a Gulbranson of, what's that?
Yeah, an organ manufacturer. In those days, we didn't have synthesizers, but these organs came with very elaborate presets, bells, whistles. Now, I was just sitting there saying, hey, look at this, you know, and I punched a button, and then it sort of sounded like a satellite. And he said, what's that? What's that? And I said, oh, it's just me. I'm just playing two notes.
Yeah. Tee, 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 tee,
and tee, yeah. Tee. And he said, we got to put that on the record. And I said, I don't know how we're going to do that because this organ weighs 4,000 pounds. You know? And he called SIR, you know, and he says, hey, Shorty, get the truck over here.
Songwriters have to have the vessels to carry the songs. Just reflect for a second on the fact that there was Glenn Campbell.
Well, when I was 14 years old, I got down on my knees beside the bed because I'd heard a Glenn Campbell record called Turn Around, Look at Me.
There is someone walking behind you. Turn around, look at me.
And I believe it was perhaps 4.5 or 5 years later that I was driving down the Santa Ana Freeway and heard Glenn Campbell singing By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
It was a magical meshing of talents. I had been writing Glenn Campbell songs. in my mind. I was ready for Glenn Campbell.
You know, you mentioned that in the book, you mentioned it as well, you know, politically on different ends of a spectrum. He was not the guy were hanging out with. You're hanging out with Harry Nielsen. And, oh, look, there's John Lennon on that Lost Weekend, which we're not going to go into that. But you're not hanging out with Glenn Campbell. But how would you describe, was it a friendship? What, how would you describe it?
Well, the first thing he ever said to me was, when are you going to get a haircut? And yet, I found out very quickly that there was hardly anyone who could stand on the same level as he could stand as a guitarist and could stand behind me, watch my hands moving on the piano, and just play along on the guitar, which is like a virtual impossibility. Mm. And partially because of the tension, I think, between us. Mm. Out of that came, I think, some of the maybe some of the nicest records of that period.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing.
The main reason I'm doing the concert, because he really taught me a lesson in bravery. He taught me a lesson in what it really means to be a man when he contracted that disease and the way he dealt with that.
Okay, now.
And I've grown up a lot since I met Glenn.
Jimmy Webb, his new memoir is The Cake and the Rain. We'll have an excerpt at herenow.org. Jimmy, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be with you again. That's an extra bonus. Maybe again sometime.
Yeah. Oh, no, we're not done. Right, right. Bye-bye.
Okay.
And
all
best
right,
of luck. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, bye.
Adios. We never really made it, baby, but we came pretty close. Adios,
The House Financial Services Committee started work today on a bill that would undo much of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act passed after the financial crisis. President Trump has long promised to roll back parts of Dodd-Frank. He also told Bloomberg News yesterday that he is considering taking steps to break up big Wall Street banks. But later in the day, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said that Trump was just restating past positions and that the administration is not ready to roll out details yet. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He joins us from New York. Hi, Ali.
Hello, Jeremy.
So the president said he's looking at breaking up banks and going back to, quote, the old system, which I guess refers to the Glass-Steagall Act that was repealed in 1999.
Keeps coming back, this Glass-Steagall Act. I'll say this. Markets didn't react very strongly to it because, you know, sometimes the president says he's actually going to do something and it doesn't get done. So the idea that he's just considering it means we're not taking it too seriously yet. But it's important. The Glass-Steagall Act was enacted in 1933, and the concept was to keep banks that took depositors' money and lent it out to people starting a business or buying a home, to keep that kind of banking separate from investment banking, which is where you go if you want to take your company public or you want to merge with someone else. And the idea was these are really two different businesses. Now, over the years, getting into the 90s, what we found is that banks had better ways to make money than simply taking deposits and lending it out to people. They were trading stocks. They were trading derivatives. They wanted to do more. So Glass-Steagall looked quaint and out of date, so it was repealed in 1999. And there are a lot of people who point to that repeal as creating banks that were too big to fail. They were too intertwined,
right.
And if anything went wrong, they would take a lot of people down with them, and that's where we are now.
So if we hear Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, saying that he wants a 21st century Glass-Steagall, what would that mean?
Well, I think the point is to allow financial institutions the freedom to do more things to make money without endangering the health of the financial system. You remember during the financial crisis, they deemed a lot of the major banks systemically important, which means the government got involved to bail them out or potentially bail them out because a failure would be catastrophic and go well beyond the banks. I mean, if a normal business goes out of business, it doesn't affect anyone but the shareholders of that business. If a bank were to go out of business today, a major bank, the domino effect would be great. So I think he's talking about giving the banks the freedom they've come to enjoy, but the ability to not take down the system if they make bad decisions.
Okay, but we're talking about an administration that has a lot of people from Wall Street, including Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, who just yesterday told Wall Street managers, you can thank me for your bank stocks doing better. Is this really the administration that is going to reinstate Glass-Steagall or something like it?
In a word, probably not, which is why you saw bank stocks yesterday after this news soften just a little bit. But they've had a remarkable run since Donald Trump became president. They don't really believe with Steve Mnuchin there, with Gary Cohn there. There are six or eight people from Goldman in senior right. administrative positions. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase have been the biggest beneficiaries of banks getting into every business in the world. You're not going to see this happen anytime soon. But at least it's worth knowing what it's all about.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC, anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And it's been 2 weeks since Justice Neil Gorsuch took his seat on the Supreme Court, on the end of the bench where new justices sit in order of seniority. These were some of the busiest 2 weeks of the term, and the newest associate justice heard oral arguments in 13 cases. And for the rest of this month and next, the court will be issuing opinions and granting cases for next term. So what did these 2 weeks tell us about this justice who will likely move up on that bench over decades? Chris Geidner joins us. He's legal editor and Supreme Court correspondent for BuzzFeed. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. And you had one of those front row seats. Just start with day one. What was your impression of Justice Gorsuch?
Yeah, I mean, those of us who cover the court have been sort of watching this eight-justice court for the past year. And so the first day that Justice Gorsuch joined the court, the justices were almost giddy as the day got underway. Even Justice Alito, who's not known for his humor on the bench, was sort of giving some laugh lines throughout the morning.
Well, why? Are you saying it's because they were so happy finally to have the ninth?
Yeah, they were just like, oh, we've got a, it's, I mean, it was
we're
sort
complete.
Of like a new classmate mid-semester who joined.
Well, that's what some of the other observers had said, that he does almost look like not just the new classmate, but the fresh new, I mean, he's young, and
yeah.
he seems very eager, maybe overly eager. Apparently, he jumped out with some geography notes about the area because they were talking about his region. I guess somebody asked about a road and in Montana, and he jumped in and corrected another justice saying, it's I-80 across Montana. And then a few minutes later, he had to say, no, wait a second, it's 90 across Montana. A lot of laughter in there. But it illustrated to some people that he was just really eager to be involved.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who was on a federal appeals court for the past dozen years. And so he's sort of now the new fish in the bigger pond mm-hmm. and wants to make sure to show his colleagues that he knows what's going on. He's ready to jump in. He wants to be a part of this. And like you said, he's young. He's going to be there for decades.
Well, talk about the fact he seems to be staying with one note, almost like he's reading off a card. And does this have to do with the fact that he's a strict interpreter of the Constitution and simple language?
A lot of his questions have been questions about originalism and textualism, sort of what was the original purpose of this law? What were the words of the law? One of his first things was sort of there was a question raised and the lawyer was like, we're not asking you to break new ground. And he said, no, you're asking us to just keep making things up. And that sort of took a bunch of people both on the bench and in the press seats, sort of gave us a surprise because he was talking about an opinion that his new colleagues had written just in recent years. And it was sort of a shot across the bow that he realizes he's now one of them and he's not obligated to agree with what they've said, which is different from what his role obviously was when he was on the Tenth Circuit for the past decade.
He also bemoaned linguistic somersaults. I mean, he just really wants to stick with the strict interpretation, as you said, and not, as you said, in his view, make things up. But there was the recent court case in which the Supreme Court was weighing in on whether or not to allow the Arkansas State Supreme Court stays of execution, those eight inmates that the state wanted to execute in 11 days before the state's supply of lethal injection drugs expired. How did he weigh in on that?
Yeah, on the first question of whether to overrule the Arkansas Supreme Court, we don't know what the actual vote of the justices were, but he didn't issue any dissent. So he potentially let that go forward, but it's also possible he opposed it. But on a second case that all of the inmates brought over whether the state's lethal injection process itself was unconstitutional, the Supreme Court did split 5-4, and the four liberal justices would have stopped all of the executions from going forward in Arkansas. And while Justice Gorsuch didn't write anything, he had clearly joined the other conservative justices in allowing the executions to go forward.
What else are you seeing from Justice Gorsuch that tells you who he's going to be, more than maybe we knew going in?
I think that, honestly, it's not necessarily the most satisfying answer, but I think we need to wait and see. I think that he was put in this awkward position of needing to start right away. Remember, most justices start over the summer after a retirement is announced, and so they get some time to bone up before they have to go on the bench. What we want to be watching is what new cases does the court take, because those will be cases that he's participated in deciding whether to take. And then when we get underway with the new term in October, he'll have had the full time that justices have to sit with the cases. And I suspect that he'll come in with more than just one question, and he'll be more engaged with the back and forth that we've come to expect for justices. So I'm definitely watching to see what and how he becomes more engaged as he gets more involved in the working of the court.
And what are some cases on the horizon that will help you do that?
Well, the first thing that we're going to be watching for is, of these 13 cases that he heard, what opinions does he write? He'll probably have one or two opinions this term, plus if he writes any concurring opinions or dissenting opinions. And obviously the case that a lot of people are paying very close attention to with Justice Gorsuch is the Trinity Lutheran case, where there was the question about whether or not the church could apply to be part of a grant program that the state of Missouri was operating. It had to do with recycled tires being used in playground surfaces. And Missouri has a law in its constitution that says that no public funds can go to churches. And so this isn't a question of the Establishment Clause and whether or not this is creating a religious entanglement. It's a question of free exercise and whether or not it is disadvantaging the church by not allowing it to participate. And Justice Gorsuch has a history of writing aggressively about religious freedom. And so people were watching at argument for what he had to say, and will certainly be watching to see if he writes the opinion or writes his own separate opinion about the case. And that will be our first real chance at seeing what Neil Gorsuch is made of.
Is it possible that the court might even take on more high-profile controversial cases now that they have the ninth seat?
Yeah, a lot of us were feeling like this term was sort of an under-the-radar term. There remains the question of whether or not the Supreme Court is going to take up the North Carolina voter ID case, whether or not the Supreme Court is going to take up the Masterpiece Cake Shop case out of Washington that has to do with this religious refusal for same-sex wedding cake question that's been percolating around the country over the past 2 years since the Supreme Court's marriage ruling. And that's been sort of pending before the justices for a while now, and we haven't heard whether or not the court's going to take it. Some of us are thinking that it means that the court's not taking it and somebody's writing an opinion expressing their disagreement with the fact that the court isn't taking it. That's something else that we could be getting an opinion from Gorsuch on. Or if they take it, there could be a real question about whether the court is going to sort of place a limit on what its marriage ruling means and how that ruling plays out in the public square.
We will see. Chris Geidner, legal editor and Supreme Court correspondent for BuzzFeed, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
There have always been people who are worried about the apocalypse. They're afraid of major terrorist attacks or a natural disaster or the breakdown of law and order. Catering to those fears and helping people prepare to survive the next big calamity has become a big business, and it's growing. Frank Morris from Here and Now contributor KCUR in Kansas City went underground to find out how preparing for doomsday has changed in the age of President Trump.
Turn right onto US 81 North.
I've been driving these little state highways for hours towards a semi-secret location in north central Kansas, very close to the geographical center of the United States. A guy named Larry Hall has built a luxury condo in a nuclear missile silo. What you see from the road looks like a grassy mound surrounded by barbed wire with a couple of armored vehicles and a guard box.
Morning, Frank. You got any weapons or anything?
I don't.
In your vehicle? No weapons, no personal weapons. Why don't you pull in?
A massive concrete entrance frames a set of heavy steel blast doors. This is Larry Hall's survival shelter, an old Atlas missile silo where 70 or so people may ride out the apocalypse.
Those are three nuclear, biological, and chemical air filtration units, and we filter every known pathogen to man, including things like weaponized nerve gas. So
this place has two generators, 2.5 years worth of fuel, a wind turbine, and a battery big enough to power the place for a day. Hall says they've got about 5 years worth of food and a secure filtered well. Some of the walls are 9 feet thick. This place sinks 200 feet into the prairie. But it is not austere.
You'll tell the difference as soon as we open this door. Welcome to Florida.
We're walking through a hatch into a warm, humid room painted to look like a beach. There's a 75-foot-long saltwater pool.
We got a waterfall. We got a water slide. We got rocks. I mean, this is a resort-style pool in an underground nuclear-hardened bunker.
12 apartments here are just as nice, all decked out with virtual windows, walk-in closets, and high-end appliances. The units sell for up to $3 million a pop, plus $5,000 a month. And they're all gone.
It's full. It's sold out. Yeah, this place is sold out.
Hall's busy filling up a second survival bunker, one three times this size, as his client base expands.
Yeah, I would say back in the original time when we were building these, there were more Republicans that were fearful of, you know, the presidency. And in the last year and a half, there's been a switch.
A switch to more liberal people, those worried primarily about war, societal collapse under President Trump, or about climate change. And despite all the pessimism and interest in dystopian fiction these days, Hall says that actually preparing to survive a real calamity can be a tough transition for progressives.
I've had A-list Hollywood people call me. Yeah, I can't tell you who said this, but the quote was, "In Hollywood, it's easier to come out and join the LGBT community and say that you're gay than it is to come out and say you're a prepper. You just don't do it. People will ridicule you and pick on you."
But the stigma of spending time and money prepping for some nightmarish future may be fading. Glitchy scenes of mayhem and destruction flash in this video, advertising a survival shelter company run by Robert Vecino.
It has gone from, oh my God, to mainstream and beyond.
Vecino says his business is up dramatically over the last year. He's catering primarily to a more middle-class customer.
We're not trying to build the Ritz. It's really all about survival.
Vecino's developing 575 World War II-era munitions storage bunkers on a sprawling site in South Dakota. $25,000 will get you into a bare concrete bunker. He had planned an even bigger shelter in Atchison, Kansas. It was going to be in a limestone mine, one where the Army stored equipment. A year into the project, Vecino says he asked an Army geologist why the stone ceilings kept doming out or, you know, dropping huge rocks.
There's a reason the Army pulled out of there, because they couldn't stabilize the facility.
The moral here is that just because the military used it doesn't mean it's safe.
Exercise and spa level.
Back down in Larry Hall's underground condo, he's talking about the next project going in. He won't say where, but responding to consumer demand, it's going to be even fancier.
There were a lot of toys that the people wanted to add. And the new one, you know, we had a golf simulator. There's a big golf simulator. There's a bowling alley. They've wanted to make the shooting range bigger. They wanted the movie theater bigger.
Hall is a busy guy.
The goal is to get the next one built and the next one built and the next one built and build the next gen. I'm looking.
It's a business plan that banks on sustained anxiety, which in the current political climate seems like a pretty safe bet. For Here and Now, I'm Frank Morris.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.